Live from KCUR News, this is Casey Currents on Central Standard, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. The hopes of Kansas City public school officials were dashed last month when Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro recommended that the district stay unaccredited. This week on Casey Currents, we visit a school that's helping the district make progress towards accreditation.
Teaching me to ride his big, heavy bicycle. If only I had a bicycle of my own.
And we'll hear from Commissioner Nicastro about her recommendation and its potential impact on other local school districts. Plus, Sprint tries to attract app makers to the crossroads.
It's going to change a lot about how we do stuff in Madison, absolutely.
And we bring you the story of a local musician turned activist. It's Casey Currents. Listen up just after this news. Welcome to Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. It seems like every time there's been a glimmer of hope for the unaccredited Kansas City public schools, those hopes are dashed. In August, KCPS made a big improvement in its report card from the state, meeting the numerical cutoff for provisional accreditation. But in September, Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro recommended that the district stay unaccredited until it shows it can sustain those improvements. We're going to talk to her about that decision in just a few minutes. Call in with your questions for Dr. Nicastro at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or comment on KCUR's Facebook page. But before we get to that, we want to visit James Elementary School in KC's historic Northeast neighborhood. The school's seen some substantial improvement in student test scores and recently landed on Missouri's list of most improved low-income schools. I went to meet the woman behind the transformation.
I'm Dr. Joe Nemeth, and this is my third year at James. We've been a school that had our share of struggles. A few years ago, our district closed down half the schools in the school district. So when we all came together, we introduced ourselves and realized we came from seven different schools. And so we decided that we had an opportunity to come together, to work hard, and the hard work has paid off.
On the most recent state tests, James students went from 16 to 30% on grade level for reading. Although these scores might sound like nothing to write home about, it was a significant improvement for a school where most students are low-income and English language learners.
We celebrated for one evening. I took everybody to dinner, but the next day it was back to hard work, rigor, collaboration.
Dr. Joe's office has plum-colored walls, a bright yellow couch, and a little table just big enough for a desktop computer. I keep wondering, where's her big principal's desk? Dr. Joe says she just doesn't spend a lot of time there.
I like to be where the students are. I like to be out helping.
Way to go!
Let's go!
Click, move on.
She takes me to a kindergarten class where students are just learning how to use their new laptop computers. Every child in the school has been assigned one. Dr. Joe says the technology helps teachers, like Mrs. Jenkins here, individualize learning for each child.
Can you show them where the letter S is?
Okay, but you don't touch this, okay?
All right, move your cursor over here. Okay, try. It says try again.
S right there.
Okay, yeah, that's it. All right, good job.
One of the first priorities that I set when I became the principal here 3 years ago was to assure that the teachers had the latest 21st century technology, the same technology they have in Overland Park and Lee Summit and Blue Springs.
Beyond technology, Dr. Joe attributes the school's success to a hardworking staff, an intense focus on literacy skills, reading and writing, and introducing kids to the idea of college early on. She doesn't mention discipline until I bring it up.
You don't have to worry about the code of conduct so much if you have rigorous teaching. If students are really engaged, they don't have a lot of other time to be exploring other things they shouldn't be doing.
If only I had a bicycle of my own.
In Mrs. Jimenez's third grade class, kids are reading in pairs on a rug. Others are revising personal narratives.
What are you writing about today?
I'm reading about.
Dr. Joe is encouraging, but has some advice.
Well, I want you to look at this one more time, because one thing I'm kind of noticing is, on your paragraphs, you're forgetting to indent.
Parents, teachers, even kids have gotten frustrated with the constant change in the Kansas City School District. New superintendents, new reading programs, school configurations. But Principal Joe Nemeth is encouraged about the changes at the school district.
I'm a person that thrives on change. Obviously, the proof is in the pudding. Our test scores have gone up. We've gotten more points towards accreditation than we've gotten before. And I think that we're on to a formula for success.
Now, Dr. Joe knows that the school and her district are not performing at the level they need to yet. District-wide, 70% of students are still not proficient in reading and math. Still, Kansas City's earned 60% of the possible points in on its state report card. That was up from 20% in preliminary assessment last year. 50% was the cutoff to be considered for provisional accreditation. Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro still wants to hold off. She joins us now over the phone from Jefferson City. Welcome to KC Currents, Dr. Nicastro.
Thank you so much, Sylvia. Pleasure to be with you.
Dr. Nicastro, why not give Kansas City credit for the improvement it's made?
I think that the way the system is set up, Sylvia, they certainly do get credit, and we're very pleased to see the work that Kansas City and the folks in Kansas City have done in this past year. What's important is that we look at sustainable improvement. In our former systems, our former school improvement accountability systems, we had very little flexibility in terms of making decisions about when districts would be accredited or when they would change their status. Under the current system, we've deliberately designed it so that we can identify trends over what we would prefer to be a three-year period in order to ensure that whatever improvement we see can and will be sustainable.
And what are the implications of having an unaccredited school system? Does it hurt kids trying to get into college?
You know, we've been very, very, I guess, gratified to see that generally colleges and universities, at least to our knowledge, have not penalized individual students for what may be the systemic failure of their school district. We've noted that as we've tried to track that information, that we've not seen individual kids handicapped by that status. I think it's important, however, to communities that their schools reflect quality, and certainly we know that having an unaccredited school district can and does have implications on the community itself.
So is it more that the factors leading to it being unaccredited are the problem rather than the fact as to whether it actually is accredited or not accredited?
It's the accreditation system in our state is one that's made up of multiple measures. One of the things that we think is an advantage for our system over some that some states use is that we do use multiple measures. It's not just one test score on one day that determines that status for school. So those multiple measures are all things that we believe are important, things like academic achievement, attendance, the college and career-ready measures that we use of ACT, SAT, ASVAB, all of those things are indicators of performance that we think give us a really robust picture of how the district is doing.
And were you surprised, considering all those measures, that the district managed to make the gains it did on the state report card?
Well, we were hopeful. We certainly are in close touch with the school district. We have staff people who work with them on a regular basis. And we have been very encouraged by Dr. Green's leadership and that of his leadership team. We also know that because the new accreditation system is designed to give credit for growth, that districts like Kansas City that are struggling will, in fact, be able to show growth 1 year over another. But that's exactly why it's important for us to have more than 1 year of data. 1 year of growth could be attributable to many factors. We're hoping that it's due to systemic changes that will have implications over time. But until we actually have that additional data, we can't determine that for sure.
How much variation do you see from year to year on test scores?
Really very little. If you look specifically at the academic scores, there has been very little change in Kansas City over the years. particularly in math and communication arts. They did show a pretty significant increase this year in social studies and science. Again, that could be attributable to many factors. We're hoping that that's sustainable improvement. But until we have additional years of data, it's going to be difficult to make that call.
Kansas City, what do you think about the implications of the school district's accreditation? Are you concerned about the impact of the district's accreditation on other local districts? Join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or tweet us at Casey Currents. You can also go to our Facebook page. Now, what do you want to see for Kansas City to regain provisional accreditation?
We have a system in place that's based, as I said, on multiple years of data. So originally, when we put out the guidance for our current system, what superintendents all over the state actually encouraged us to do was to wait until 2015 before we would reclassify schools. And that is what, in fact, we agreed to do. Districts everywhere, not just Kansas City, but as you can expect, districts all over the state were concerned about a new system of accountability. Any time you change systems, there are always some questions and some uncertainties about what that might look like. So we agreed to hold off until 2015 before we made any of those calls for districts. Of course, right now, that decision does not particularly serve Kansas City's interest, and we certainly understand that. But nevertheless, we believe that was the right thing to do, not only for the sake of the districts, but because we want to maintain the integrity of the system that we've established.
And, of course, a lot of other area districts were hoping that Kansas City would regain that provisional accreditation, because if the district remains unaccredited, that means by next year, kids will be able to transfer to neighboring accredited districts like Raytown or Independence. Now, that's all depending on the results of a case that's currently before the Missouri Supreme Court, but it's already happening in the St. Louis area, where two districts are unaccredited and thousands of students have transferred. What's your take on that situation?
Well, we understand the concerns of some of the neighboring districts. I would say a couple things. One, we haven't gotten a Supreme Court decision yet, so I think that we certainly need to wait until we get that before we can make any decisions about how that will be played out in Kansas City. Secondly, the accreditation system is about district performance. And for us, that means specifically focusing on how kids are doing. There's no reason to have any accountability system at all, or transfer law or anything else, unless we're concerned about individual children and how they are performing. The job of education is to, in fact, prepare kids for success. So, you know, as we look at these data, I think that while there are a lot of adult issues that are associated with the transfer issue, and districts have legitimate concerns about that, you know, we still have to focus on how kids are performing and how kids are being served in their home districts. Having said that, you know, superintendents in both the St. Louis and the Kansas City area are, you know, they're anxious to serve kids. They also understand that under the current transfer law, that the sending district cannot survive financially. So I think that those are issues that the legislature is going to have to wrestle with. The current law simply is not going to be one that we can sustain indefinitely. And at some point, we're either going to have to eliminate that, amend that, or figure out some other way to provide quality schools for kids.
And that was your recommendation, that the legislature eliminate this school transfer law at the hearing they had a few weeks ago?
Yeah, we presented several options. One was to eliminate it. That was our first. The second option was to make a couple changes in the law itself that would make it possible for that program to be sustained with some changes. And then the third recommendation we made, and this is really the one that we're devoting our time and energy to, and that is developing a long-range plan for how we address the needs of children in failing districts around the state. We have tried over several years to do a number of things to support and intervene districts that aren't performing at the level that we expect, and none of those has proven to be particularly effective over time. So we are looking at trying to figure out what's a better system. How can we organize ourselves statewide and locally to deliver quality schools to every child where they live?
And speaking of which, one intervention the state has made has been in St. Louis. It's been 6 years since the state took over St. Louis's public schools, and they're still provisionally accredited. And the schools actually did a lot worse than KC on the state report card. I think they got about 25%, where KC got 60% of the possible points. That doesn't seem to bode well for a state intervention.
Well, I think that's a little bit of a misnomer. Up till now, up until August 28th of this year, the State Board of Education only had three tools at its disposal for intervening in a failing district. One was to put a special administrative board in place, which is what happened in Kansas City, or I'm sorry, in St. Louis. Actually, in St. Louis, they're governed by a different law, so the State Board itself did not appoint that special administrative board. But nevertheless, when that happens, the governance of that district transfers to that special administrative board, not to the State Board of Education. So it's that SAB that has been governing the district and does govern the district. The other two tools that have been at the State Board's disposal has to do with merging the district with another or dividing it up. We've tried pieces of all of that, and again, hasn't proven to solve the actual problem, which is performance at the local level. Hmm. That's why we're looking for an alternative. We think this is the time for us to come up with something that can be more creative and provide better services to kids.
Kansas City, what questions do you have for Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro, we're talking to today? Call 816-235-2888, or you can go to our Facebook page, the KCUR Facebook page. So you're talking about some of those other options. Are there some on the table now?
We're working on a plan to develop a system of support and intervention statewide that will make sense. What we know for sure is that Kansas City and St. Louis and other parts of the state are very different. They have distinct needs and distinct community issues that drive whatever that looks like. So while we would be interested in developing some state level of support or some state network that the department would be responsible for operating, again, that governance is going to have to take place to some degree, to a large degree, at the local level. What we know for sure about school improvement is that it happens one school at a time. When you talk about school improvement, you have to focus on what happens in classrooms, teaching and learning. The principal you had on previously, I think, articulated that very well when she said, we're focusing on what we do for kids and how we improve our classroom practice so that kids can be successful. That's exactly what needs to happen.
And is one possibility to just let the district continue on with its plan that it's put into place with the state, of course?
Well, there are lots of possibilities. And, it's one reason, though, some have said, why haven't we intervened as yet? Since August 28th, the State Board has the authority now to do something different. And I think we would just remind people that, first of all, that law did pass, and we do have that, the State Board does have that authority. However, the law also requires that we do some preliminary work and that we engage the community and get people's ideas and be very very transparent about what that looks like. So at the current time, we're conducting some focus groups, some interviews, we're gathering information, we're analyzing previous plans, we're looking at what successful districts around the country may have done. And then in January, we're planning to roll out the structure of a draft of a plan for community feedback and input. And we certainly would invite all of your listeners and others in Kansas City to weigh in on that.
Hmm. And there are a lot of skeptical people in Kansas City thinking we've had consultants here before. I know there's some consultants that are being funded by the Kauffman Foundation. I think another group here working with you all to begin these community-wide discussions. But it's been happening for many years now. What's going to be different this time?
Well, I think that in the past what we've tried to do is tweak a system that hasn't worked. And what we're doing now and what we've asked our consultants to do is to really start with a blank page. We need to get beyond the constraints of the school districts and the school systems and the structures that have traditionally governed our schools and start with the child. If you plan from the child up and out, I suspect that some of those structures that we've had in place for generations may look very different.
You're listening to Casey Currents on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking with Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro. Have you noticed a change in the Kansas City public schools? Do the numbers match up to your experience? Give us a call, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at kccurrents@kcur.org. Commissioner Nicastro, I think to ask a broader question, you're talking about looking at the whole child. You know, many Kansas City educators say that ultimately the challenge here is not the district, the governance, but the same challenge that schools around the country face in educating poor kids. Do we as a society know how to do that?
I do think that we do. I think there are teachers and principals all over the country who have done that successfully. We can point to examples of individual schools that continue to make progress and that have really done a good job of bringing kids along. There's a whole body of research out there around 90-90-90 schools. That is, 90% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch, 90% of the kids are minority, and they're achieving at the 90% or better level. So it is those practices, it is the practices of those kinds of schools that we really need to learn from and try to figure out how can we combine all those practices into schools in an entire community so that we can serve an entire population.
Do we have any of those schools in the Kansas City area or in Missouri?
Not right now.
I wonder, are there districts in the country that are achieving that?
At the district level, I don't know of any that does that district-wide. Again, I think we're focusing on individual schools.
Now, I want to ask about some of the other districts in the Kansas City area that made some big gains on their state report cards. There was the Center School District in South Kansas City and Grandview. And, of course, there was a new form of assessment of these districts, so gains is a difficult term. But what do you think accounts for their successes? They are also educating low-income populations, although maybe not as extreme as the Kansas City district.
I think that those superintendents would tell you that exactly what I've just said, that it's school improvement happens building by building, that they have focused a lot of their time and attention on attracting and keeping good teachers and principals and focusing on those practices that have proven to be effective. In both districts, they've been using some instructional strategies that appear to be producing results. And obviously, they're doing a good job with that.
And have you been to visit those districts here? Do you think that there's some communication that can happen between them and Kansas City?
Well, I do think they communicate. The superintendents in the Kansas City area, like in other parts of our state, do get together and talk to each other and exchange ideas regularly. So I think there's a lot of that discussion already going on. There's professional development activities that have been happening in the Kansas City area that most, if not all, of the districts participate in. So there's a lot of opportunity for them to share, and certainly we encourage them to continue to do that.
We have a call here from Leslie in Kansas City. Leslie, do you have a question?
I do. So for 4 years, we've been struggling in our district, and the same oversight committee has been looking at the performance of our district. So I'm wondering what's the district doing differently now versus the last 40 years to help us right the ship.
And that's DESE, the Department of Education, Elementary and Secondary Education, that Commissioner Nicastro heads up. How can you address Leslie's question? What's different now?
I guess I didn't catch the beginning of her question. But,
well, that for 40 years there's been some kinds of interventions.
Well, yes, and I would just restate that the interventions we've done previously and others have tried previously focus on the system as it exists. And what I think we've discovered over the years, and Kansas City certainly is a great example of that, is that irrespective of leadership, who the superintendent is or who the board is, or what specific program they put in place here or there, the system itself has been broken for so long that it's very difficult for those folks to overcome the dysfunction of the system itself. So, again, we're starting at the child level. We're trying to figure out what are the necessary components that we need to put in place to intervene on their behalf, and hopefully we can come up with something better.
And what do you say to principals like the one we spoke to at the beginning of the show and the superintendent who really are discouraged by the fact that despite those gains, they haven't achieved provision, or they may not, depending on the State Board of Education's decision, achieve provisional accreditation?
Well, you know, accreditation is the outcome. It's not the goal. And I think that the goal is to improve performance for all children. And if they do that, the accreditation will take care of itself.
Will you be here? I mean, what are you hearing from people in Kansas City?
What am I hearing?
Yes.
Okay. I'm hearing all kinds of things. I think that there are many folks who are very disillusioned, like your previous caller, and I think there are people who are very energized and excited about what's happening in the district now. My sense of folks in Kansas City is that they're tired of dealing with it, that they really want their kids to have access to quality schools, and they are really looking for somebody, something that's going to make a big difference that so that they can be assured their kids are going to have that access.
Well, Dr. Chris Nicastro, thanks so much for joining us on KC Currents.
You're very welcome, Sylvia. Thank you.
Chris Nicastro is the Education Commissioner of the state of Missouri. After the break, hear the story of a local Latin musician turned community activist. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Here at KCUR, we love getting your comments on our website and Facebook page, and most of them are quite civil. But at the Kansas City Star, like newspapers across the country, sometimes comments get out of control, offensive, racist, sexist, sometimes even a little scary, particularly on certain controversial stories. So in an effort to reduce the number of anonymous trolls in the comment section on the Star's website, editors now require people to comment via their Facebook pages, where most people use their real names. KC Currents' Susan Wilson caught up with the Star's public editor, Derek Donovan, to find out more about the change.
Facebook has a vested interest in making sure that the people using Facebook are real people. The site is, or at least tries to be aggressive about weeding out and fake accounts and also spamming accounts. That's something that you used to see more in the early days of Facebook, but I don't know if you've noticed now, there's very few of them actually. And it's one of the few networks that I'm aware of that's been pretty successful at this sort of thing. And the nice thing about using Facebook comments is that when you are making a comment on a website that uses a Facebook login, it also ties back to your profile. And so your friends see what you've posted. Also, others who come into the Kansas City Star's website at kansascity.com can read a commentary that's actually tied to you as a person. And that, for one thing, I think really raises the level of engagement, and it makes people more responsible about what they post. And also, it usually makes people a little bit less forthcoming about some of the abusive behavior that they're afraid to do if somebody knows their name.
Is that part of the reason why you went to this kind of system, because of the things that people were writing?
With no question. I think that the whole concept of anonymous misbehavior on the internet really is a 1990s kind of mindset. It's something that I think is long passé, and it was without question over the past 9.5 years I've been doing this job, the number one complaint I've ever had about the website. Nothing even comes close. I cannot tell you how many people since the switch has been made to the Facebook comments have talked to me to say, I used to hesitate to click into stories many times because I just didn't want to see the nastiness. And the types of stories that would draw that nastiness were many that you would see, especially sports rivalry stories could get really awful. Stories about successful women was another magnet. You just wouldn't believe how quickly sometimes it would turn to a personal insult. Another really common thing used to be anytime a story about an accident, particularly involving a teenager, were to run on the website, that would instantly draw all sorts of nastiness. And editors made a very wise decision years ago that stories about human tragedy, accidents, crime, that sort of thing, would not host comments at all. Because really, when you think about it, what of value are you going to be able to say about something like that? You know, as a private citizen who's involved in a wreck, it's very sad, but you can't really add anything to that dialogue.
What about topics like race, religion, politics? Did those topics also draw negative responses?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, those stories would sometimes have to have the comments disabled because things did get out of hand. And the great irony of that is those are the things that I think a lot of people, particularly journalists and pundits, would argue are where we need to be having conversations. And I think a lot of people want to really work through some of these issues in a civil way, but you just couldn't keep the bomb throwers out, especially in the anonymous age.
Now, the nastiness that you saw, do you think this is part and parcel of a society where civility is really an issue right now? I mean, you see that everywhere.
I do, although it's my personal viewpoint, coupled with a lot of my education in topics of social discourse, is that we've all sort of had a little bit of willful ignorance to how civil society has always been. There's always been a seedy underbelly of incivility. And if you want to go back to some of the pamphleteering that was done in the early days of the colonies, and if you wanted to look at what newspapers were like in the late 19th century, for example, you might not have had the exact vitriol that you see in online comments, but you still had some extremely intemperate things that were said very frequently. And so I think that anonymous internet comments have enabled that to get a lot more prevalence probably, or certainly a greater visibility than it had had in the past. But it's always been there. The analogy to writing on the bathroom wall is a very true one. It's just how many people are going to see that bathroom wall versus a site like KansasCity.com that has, a million unique visitors. That's a huge canvas for that random nasty remark to get a lot of eyes.
What about critics who might say, not being able to be identified is an important aspect of providing commentary, allowing everybody to engage in a dialogue, and this might fly in the face of reader engagement?
I understand that to a certain degree, but it's not as if there are no other venues out there for that. Anybody can create a Twitter account that wants to. Anybody can create a free blog. I do think that the age of the anonymous internet commentator, as I said earlier, is really an artifact of the 90s. It's time to grow up and to move past that.
So what's been the initial reader reaction to going to a Facebook platform as opposed to anonymous comment kind of method?
It's been almost universally positive. There have been some people who have expressed very legitimate concerns about creating a Facebook account because, as we've seen, Facebook it can be a bit secretive about what it's using its user data for. And so there's some people who are saying, I don't want to give Facebook my identification or my identity. I understand that completely. And there have been some people who are upset basically that they can't go in and call people names. And, I think that quite honestly, the star is better off for not having those voices around.
Well, Derek Donovan, thank you for being on KC Currents.
It was my pleasure. Thanks.
The Kansas City Star's public editor, Derek Donovan, spoke to KC Currents' Susan Wilson. ¶¶ Medicine has been going mobile. Android phones have an app that reads sonograms. An iPhone can monitor the breathing of an asthma patient. And a BlackBerry can work as an EKG machine. Many developers say that these new apps are just the tip of the iceberg in mobile medical technology. And one of Kansas City's biggest companies is now trying to get entrepreneurs in on the action. Casey Kern's Alex Smith has the story.
Okay, can you see this number?
Yeah, it's 12.
In his Overland Park office, Dr. Rohit Krishna gives me an eye test.
Five.
For this test, there's no wall chart or any of the big contraptions that usually crowd an eye doctor's office. Dr. Krishna is doing the whole test on his iPad.
So I'm going to confirm for the listening audience that Alex can see 20/20. So we're really happy about that today.
Okay, I didn't tell Dr. Krishna that I wear contacts. Anyway, he's using an app called the Eye Handbook. Krishna, along with a handful of other UMKC medical teachers and residents, created the Eye Handbook about 4 years ago. It's especially for use in countries that don't have a lot of medical services. The handbook has reference materials, it can connect doctors to other doctors, and makes it possible to do with a phone a lot of tests that used to take a room full of machines.
So being able to check somebody's vision, like out in the middle of the desert, if you have somebody who got an eye injury and just being able to check that, whereas normally you'd have to go into an eye doctor's office.
The free app has been downloaded about 1 million times by people around the globe.
Uruguay, Costa Rica, Jordan, Slovakia, South Africa.
Now in its 13th version, the Eye Handbook is the most popular ophthalmology app in the world.
And on a daily basis, we get three or four people who just thank us a lot for, you know, putting this out, continuing the development especially.
And there are hopes this kind of success with mobile medical apps will be endemic to Kansas City.
I want to thank everybody for being here. I appreciate all of your time on a Wednesday afternoon.
Last Wednesday, the coffee shops and art studios of the Crossroads got a new neighbor. The launch of Sprint's new accelerator seemed like an art opening, with a wine and cheese cube reception in a big loft. At the event, Sprint's Kevin McGinnis announced that the company is looking for 10 groups who will receive $20,000 each and take part in a 90-day IT startup boot camp focusing on mobile medical technology. TechStars, which is a business accelerator based in Boulder, will train the 10 groups.
They're literally told that they'll be moving to Kansas City if they're from outside the area. They'll spend all day every day in the accelerator going through somewhat of an immersive session.
McGinnis says that Sprint itself isn't interested in getting involved in the risky, labor-intensive work of creating new apps, but the company does want to be involved with the people who are doing it.
By engaging in that entrepreneurial ecosystem and bringing those thoughts and those ideas back into the company through those engagements, that is something that I think we've seen some benefits, whether it's organizing hackathons or challenging people to come up with innovative ideas about our own business. Engaging in that external ecosystem is a way to actually bring that home.
Of course, the more ways there are to use phones, the better for Sprint. But that's not the only benefit for the two companies involved. TechStars gets a 6% stake in the participating businesses. Sprint is also offering the businesses a $100,000 loan, which can be converted into a share of the businesses. But Sprint and TechStars aren't the only ones who've been interested in mobile medical apps lately.
It's gone, rampant. I mean, it's gone viral.
That's Dr. Kimberly Gandy. Based in Kansas City, she developed an app called Plan It Med. It's designed to help patients follow complicated doctor's orders. There are currently over 97,000 medical apps, and the FDA estimates that by 2015, 500 million smartphone users will have at least one of them. Lots of developers are working on the next blockbuster, but Dr. Gandy believes making really useful medical apps takes more than tech smarts.
There is a huge chasm in between the understanding IT and the understanding of the medical universe.
Gandy says that part of the reason mobile medical app development has become so popular is that the medical community is willing to pay a lot for high-quality professional technology.
That's where the money is.
The FDA actually just released guidelines for regulating these pro-medical smartphone apps. Dr. Gandy likes Sprint's mentoring program and says it could help a lot of entrepreneurs deal with business challenges, but she hopes developers won't lose sight of creating apps for ordinary people to use outside of hospitals and doctor's offices.
That's where the emphasis really needs to happen, because without serving the patient population, we're sort of missing the point.
Back in his Overland Park office, Dr. Rohit Krishna says that whatever happens with mobile medical apps, they're going to make big changes for the world of medicine.
They're not even at the end of the first inning in mobile apps in the medical space. It's just absolutely booming. And it's going to change a lot about how we do stuff in medicine, absolutely.
Sprint's taking applications for its accelerator until the start of December. The program starts in March. For Casey Currents, I'm Alex Smith.
Welcome to KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We use stories and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region. Getting out of the city for a few minutes now, our rural landscapes are dotted with tall cylindrical storage containers for grain. Some are commercial grain elevators. But increasingly, farmers want to market their grain throughout the year, so they install their own storage bins. Maintaining the quality of that grain requires vigilance and can present safety concerns. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports from Iowa.
Iowa farmer Kevin Larson began farming with his dad about 40 years ago. Back then, Larson says, everyone stored corn, still on the cob, in their own cribs.
As combining, harvesting with a combine, did you get just the grain materialized? Some people just took it straight to town as grain instead of storing it on the farm.
Now, farmers see that with the right tools, on-farm storage can make sense. It's something Larson's been doing for decades. Today, he's got 10 steel grain bins, 15 to 50 feet tall. The biggest can hold 135,000 bushels of corn or soybeans. Greg Hellman, a sales rep with the grain bin maker Sukup Manufacturing, says an increasing number of farmers now can store similar quantities.
It's just exploded in the last 5 to 10 years, where a lot of these on-farm sites have become, like small elevators.
Wherever the grain is stored, the quality must be maintained or the value plummets. Larson checks his regularly.
I feel I have enough experience that I can monitor it pretty closely just by sight.
What he looks for is any sign that a crust has formed on top. Iowa State University agricultural engineering professor Carl Byrne explains how that can happen.
It's possible that some moisture will move from the bottom parts of the grain up to the top and then condense near the top level of the grain and then mold and form a hard layer, in other words, a crust.
When grain is unloading, it flows out the bottom of the bin, creating an inverted cone inside. If there's a crust on top, then a gap between that crust and the flowing grain isn't visible. When the grain stops coming out, a farmer may go in to see what's happened. It's called walking the grain. That's when disaster can strike. You hear about entrapment, often leading to death, when people punch through that crust, fall into the empty space, and then get buried as grain falls in all around them. Scott Haugan wants to stop that from ever happening.
We've been to the moon. We can do a better job taking care of grain.
Haugan's company provides monitoring technology that helps prevent crust from forming.
You think about the technology that we have in hybrids. We have disease-resistant, drought-resistant, Roundup-resistant. Then you think about the technology that producers have today with, the inside of a combine looks like the cockpit on an F-17 fighter.
Technology in the bin is the next logical step, Haugan says.
Well, today we're visiting Mid-Iowa Co-op's Midway site, a new $18 million facility they built last year.
This commercial elevator is one of Haugan's customers, and his high-tech systems are on bins throughout the Midwest. A constant data stream from inside the bin feeds the temperature and moisture conditions to software that can trigger alerts or turn fans on as necessary. A manager can view the data in the on-site control room or from a remote office or smartphone.
If you need it on the cloud, we'll get it there too.
Agreement is widespread that the best way to prevent grain bin entrapment is to keep people out of bins. And Iowa State's Byrne agrees with Haugan that the way to do that is to stop the problem-causing crust from ever forming. That's the engineering puzzle industry and academia continue to pursue. Meanwhile, Hellman, from the bin maker Sukup, says his company's Grain Buster is a low-tech device controlled from outside the bin. When the external crank is turned, a chain-covered pipe whips around inside the grain to break up the crust. Hellman says in-bin monitors from vendors like Haugan are gaining popularity, too.
15, 20 years ago, those type of temperature cables or monitoring systems were pretty non-existent on farms, and now they're becoming much more prevalent.
On-farm bin accidents used to be more common than ones at commercial sites, but that's no longer always the case. Farmer Kevin Larson says his tech-free method and cautious approach continue to serve him well.
We've done it long enough that we kind of know the symptoms and what to look for and keep an eye on it as needed.
Larson says no one on his farm enters a bin that's unloading, but he'll continue to allow walking the grain when he deems it safe. Some commercial elevators have adopted no-entry policies. That prevents entrapments and also makes those elevators ever more dependent on emerging technologies. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media. An exhibit opens this weekend at the Kansas City Museum about a local musician who became an icon in the Latino community. It's called Music is My First Love, the Lupe Gonzalez Orchestra. Casey Current's Esther Honig tells the story of how Lupe Gonzalez went from being a musician to a community leader.
You might not have heard his name before because Lupe Gonzalez never received national recognition. He was best known right here in Kansas City. Lupe Gonzalez was born in 1935 as the son of Mexican immigrants, Julie and Juan Gonzalez. He grew up here back when it was a very different place.
The Mexicans, when they go to a theater, they had to sit on the right side. The Anglos sit in the middle, and the African Americans would sit on the left. And, those who knew of that era can certainly relate and understand what my father's youth had to go through.
Eric Gonzalez is Lupe's son and the youngest of his five children.
Imagine waking up Saturday mornings and hearing your father in the front room practicing his alto saxophone.
Gonzalez was best known for playing the alto sax and inherited his love of music from his father, who worked on the Santa Fe Railroad and played music in his spare time.
Music was always a part of his life. That's why it's so eloquently read as for the exhibit is that music is my first love, which it certainly was.
Lupe Gonzalez trained as a musician from an early age and eventually played with his father's band, the Guerrancheros. In 1949, he attended the Argentine High School in Kansas City, Kansas, during its first years of desegregation. And it was there that he received his formal training as a member of the school's orchestra.
Back then, my father had the opportunity to study under Bob Lieben, whose family was a part of the development of our Kansas City Philharmonic Orchestra. By the time that these kids were seniors, can you imagine how professional of musicians that they were?
Gonzalez grew into a talented musician and founded the Lupe Gonzalez Orchestra. This eight-piece band played traditional Mexican music, but also integrated the popular music of the day.
Was a rhythm called the danzón, cha-cha-cha, boleros, of course, rancheras, corridos, and then, of course, the show tunes of those from Glenn Miller. So.
The orchestra became well-known within Kansas City and throughout the Midwest, playing in dance halls for community events and family celebrations. His music had the ability to bring people together and gave Gonzalez the chance to stand out as a leader.
You see, music created a lot of opportunity for Lupe to get involved.
That's Gonzalez's longtime friend and former colleague, Richard Ruiz.
When you're the leader of a group that is in demand, many people approach you and say, hey, can you help us with a benefit? Can you help us? We're trying to raise money for this family whose house burnt down, or we're trying to raise money for the church. And those requests get people like Lupe more and more involved in the community and understanding the issues and the needs and the wants. And so that music ability and skill that Lupe had led into his leadership role.
And that's how Gonzalez began his career as a community leader, starting in the 1960s and up until the late 80s. He wrote for the KC Hispanic News, helped to create and manage a job training organization, and volunteered his time to support many local causes.
Hispanics were like maybe 3-4% of the population, so we were very much a minority. Nobody cared about us. Our numbers weren't great enough to be concerned about. And so we, over and over again, would see a discrimination occur.
Gonzalez worked alongside many others, including Richard Ruiz, to stand up against the prejudice affecting their community.
Our local police department determined that it was okay for their police officers to get a bounty fee for apprehending undocumented citizens. When asked, how do you determine if someone is undocumented? They just said, well, they look dirty. They're usually by the railroad tracks. They look like, you know, they're walking. Heck, in Argentine, that was our fathers. Our fathers would get off work at the railroad, and they would walk home across the bridge.
Gonzalez, along with others, confronted the department and were successful at stopping the police's campaign. Gonzalez passed away in 2008, leaving behind this and other lasting influences. This Saturday is the opening of the Lupe Gonzalez exhibit at the Kansas City Museum. Supported by the advisory committee Nuestra Gerencia and the Gonzalez family, this is the museum's first Latino exhibit.
It's about time to acknowledge our community and our leadership, and at the same time, someone who mastered the art of music.
The exhibit opens this weekend and runs until the 29th of December. For Casey Currents, I'm Esther Honig.
That's it for Casey Currents today. Our live broadcast will be every Thursday morning from now on. If you missed part of the show, want to hear it again, or subscribe to the podcast, check out our page at kcur.org. Contact us at kcurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kcurrents. Central Standard returns tomorrow with the Movie Critics. Coming up on Up to Date, an inside look at Family Court. Today's Casey Currents was produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Suzanne Hogan, Alex Smith, and Susan Wilson. Our interns are Esther Honig, Ross Steinmetz, and Sydney Llewellyn. Theme music is by Approach. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.